Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. You must listen to the open loops, a theme park for absurd beliefs and systems of integration between the mind and the creative spirit. Open loops.
Are you asleep? Or are you just watching the congressional hearings on UAPs? Doesn't matter. Your unconscious mind is wide awake and tuned in to its favorite late-night talk show for the shamelessly fringe. It's Open Loops with Greg Bornstein. Conversations that bend. Indeed, it is I, Greg Bornstein. Good day. Thank you for tuning in. What a fringe-filled week it's already been so far. I'm going to talk about the UFO, UAP hearings and Congress in a little bit before I introduce today's guest. Now, as your resident looper, cultural hypnotist, consciousness disruptor, curator of experience, I have to tell you, this show, this episode is everything that I started Open Loops for. Why? Because it's one man that contains everything. I talk about how I want to challenge existing viewpoints on this show and entertain, intellectually stimulating, escapist in a way, but not really escapist, but perhaps out of the ordinary topics, psychology, parapsychology, aliens, really hypnosis, altered state of consciousness, shamanism. We talk about it all, and actually not really with aliens, this guest, but certainly everything ESP and dream telepathic. My guest, Stanley Krippner, PhD. He is such a legend. He's coming on. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit, too. Why don't I start with the snooze fest that was congressional hearings on UFOs. I don't want to go into this too much because I know every other one of these podcasts is doing this, but I think there is a lot of excitement in the spiritual community, and I am happy to be a part of this consciousness alternative awakening movement by even doing the show. I mean, that's the thing. By publicly entertaining these topics, you're already making a difference. I've said it. I say it on all the conferences I do. To go into conversation and talk about these things makes them that much more likely to be something people take seriously. Now, are they worth taking seriously? Well, enough people have had experiences to at least discuss it. So why hide? One of the things you'll hear my guests all the time say, I felt these abilities, but I was ashamed of them. I didn't know what to do with them, so I hid them. I had these experiences, and I hid them. And really, this call for an awakening, this call for ascension, moving into the fifth dimension, this call for everybody to become more self-realized, i.e. the great resignation, the great quote-unquote reset, though not their reset, your internal reset post-COVID in this world. Oh no, I said the word. Here's the question. Will having a show where I talk about aliens and say the word COVID mean that this is not going to be heard somewhere? We'll find out. Alexa, you know you like this show. Come on, girl. Keep listening. Anyways, what I was going to say is that the part of the awakening is simply opening up to these anomalous experiences being real. That's even why my guest today is so important in the field, and why even though they did choose the, I was watching Alan Steinfeld on his YouTube channel, New Realities. I was watching his watch party of the UAP hearings today in Congress. So unremarkable. I mean, he was saying it, his guests were saying it. They chose the worst footage of a UFO. There's so much footage out there. They didn't. Alan was wondering if they'd use the alien word. Extraterrestrial came up. Republican Governor Michael Gallagher, I believe his name, was asking tough questions about why they appear over nuclear sites. What about the, there's this thing called the Wilson Memo that was leaked a few years back, where someone in the government was talking with a, I think he was a doctor. And in this document, he talks about technology and items that are of extraterrestrial origin. And that was brought up, the Wilson leak. That was a huge moment. So props to Gallagher on that. Last time that sentence, props to Gallagher, will ever. Yeah, that's like a triple entendre. Look that up. Yeah, so the point being, though, that it was a lot of government doublespeak. A lot of... here's the thing. Even someone commented. I posted something on social media, and someone wrote, "Yeah, see, they said that we can reasonably be assured that none of these things aren't terrestrial, i.e., they come from this planet." Okay, that's great, and this is why I question the institution of, well, not even the institution, our propensity to even want to hold a government up to anything. I mean, sometimes you just want to tear down the system because you're going, how many times has the government lied about everything? And if UFOs are top secret, they're not going to tell us that. They're not going to reveal the top secret case files today. This hearing was BS. I mean, yes, the Pentagon has put out more stuff recently, and I'm not even sure why they've done it, but clearly they want to bring this stuff more into our consciousness and just not tell us anything about it. They're a bunch of teases, this government agency, these agencies. Why even, I mean, they pulled a congressional hearing to just tell us that they think that most of these are terrestrial and that they want to streamline the report. They want to standardize the reporting of these sightings so that people aren't afraid. Pilots, people looking at radars, I mean, people can feel open in government positions to share as they continue. And they basically ignored all the other testimonies, and they didn't go into other footage, and they didn't even delve into Tic Tac. I mean, there's so many things they could have done and didn't. Now, flip side of this, of course, is that it's great. Again, this is part of the awakening. The fact that they're even doing a hearing after not having one for 50 years is, you know, it's something. It at least gets the conversation going. So I am happy about that. And I'm continually not surprised that we learn nothing from these hearings. It's the great disappointment. Another great in our times. Yes. So what I will say that's interesting, though, and here's a strange, just paradoxical thing in the movement of conspiracy and conspirituality and aliens and UFOs, something that I still can't quite figure out is we have only so much evidence that is publicly shared, but the paradox of it is that then you say, well, why isn't there evidence about this specific thing out there? And then we can only rely on witness testimony. And that is tricky. Now, that's not to say witness testimony isn't sufficient evidence for things. I mean, I guess in the realm of science and quote unquote proper research, we can't just rely on anecdotal testimony, even though thousands and thousands of people for thousands and thousands of years have experienced similar phenomenon. But even still, if we're not getting any evidence that or anything tangible about hyper advanced technology on paper that says, hey, the government does have this, we have seen this, this comes from another planet, here's why. Then the flip side of the argument is, yeah, and that goes to show you how secretive they're keeping it, because it would be in the best interests of these powerful business empires to prevent this technology from coming out. So it's even more proof. Oh, of course you're not going to get it. So then, as an outside observer, as a researcher of this, as somebody that podcasts, I'm sitting here going, is there something we can hold on to here? Is there everybody that claims they're part of the secret space program? No evidence, no actual tangible evidence that I've seen, but that's why it's a secret. It's that Steve Martin made that joke when he hosted the Oscars, and I'll never forget it. He said, you know what? That movie, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, why do you want that? It's crazy that this movie is so beautiful, but there are no tigers or dragons in the entire thing. And then I think to myself, oh, it's because they're crouching and hiding. A tricky paradox to overcome, which is why my guest, Stanley Krippner, PhD, this guy has been doing so much incredible work. This is a testimony to a lifetime of finding tangible evidence. I mean, you'll hear it in this interview. It almost sounds as if I was almost embarrassed to ask some of the hypothetical, typical open loops questions that I ask, because he was going, well, I don't entertain hypotheticals. I look at evidence. I get it. I get it. His whole career, he has been doing parapsychological and psychological research. He is on the board of so many different legitimate organizations in the mind, in the spirit. I mean, altered states of consciousness. He was a hypnotist and a magician growing up. A hypnotist and a magician? And that's what really, I mean, he also had a precognitive experience that got him super. I believe the story is, and I referenced this in the podcast, Stanley really wanted to buy an encyclopedia that cost $100. His uncle was rich. This is in Wisconsin. His uncle was going to, well, he thought to himself, the only person in my family that can get that for me as a gift is my uncle. And then he had the thought in his head, but that's not going to work out because he's dead. Which that thought came out of nowhere. And then he got a, well, he didn't get, his mother got a phone call. Yeah, that is some messed up stuff. And I can imagine how an experience like that it just hits you, would make you want to study precognitive dreams and the abilities to communicate telepathically, as well as other fields. I mean, this is a man who's studied shamanism, altered states of consciousness, like I said. I mean, hypnosis and the powers of altering your consciousness for going into different trance states and Really, also understanding the mind. I mean, I think one of the coolest aspects of Stanley Krippner's research, in addition to the fact that he was in Brooklyn, where I am, for years, doing dream telepathy experiments in Maimonides Hospital, their basement, sending messages and images via. They were doing research with different cables. I mean, I have this book, Dream Telepathy, I picked up at a used bookstore, and it documents all the research. It's very interesting stuff. And even he had Mickey Hart from The Grateful Dead. He hypnotized Mickey Hart, but also that summer, there was one summer where during one of the Grateful Dead concerts, they all wanted to partake in the experiment. So they had their entire audience, who everybody was tripping balls on acid at the time, they had the entire audience send images to one of the psychics in the hospital. So interesting. I mean, this guy has had such an interesting life, and the variety of people he's touched is. I was reading a book. Everyone should read this. It's a compilation compiled by Janine Davies and Daniel Pitchford. Stanley Krippner, A Life of Dreams, Myths, and Visions. Very, very big. I mean, Stanley's written so many books, but this is like a great, great, great. Very interesting. It gives you really the broad scope of his life and his contributions to the fields that he's partaken. And he really has contributed so much. He's researched and written so many papers. Yeah, like I said, a lifelong dedication to all things mystical and psychological. Teaching people personal mythology, building off of Jung and Joseph Campbell, and having people present their dreams to him. This is somebody that is, and still is, dedicated to the mind, and dedicated, and this is what I was going to say before, dedicated to using research and numbers to show how pathological explanations, i.e., I'm psychic because of some delusion in my head, don't answer why these things are happening. We talk about that on the show. I got originally wanted a half hour. I squeezed an hour out of him. I mean, he's an older gentleman, so he has to use his voice, and he does sound great. He sounds alive. He cares passionately. I really loved him. I'm so honored. I mean, he tells me I'm too complimentary of his work, but this is a. I would not be here if it weren't for this guy, in the sense that he legitimized a lot of these fields. Even James Randi, the great skeptic, like Stanley Krippner, bringing evidence to the paranormal, he is the doctor of dreams. I hope you enjoy this interview. And before we get into this, please, I'm gonna run this whole thing, I'm not gonna put in a plug. So if you like Open Loops, please make sure to go to ratethispodcast.com/openloops, just so we can know you're out there listening, and that this content can be, it's very important for the algorithms to be seen more. So any words, any rating, I am very grateful for you listening. Thank you, Stanley. Here he is, Dr. Stanley Krippner. Today on Open Loops, we have Dr. Stanley Krippner. This is a legend. A absolute an icon in parapsychology, shamanistic research, mythology, psychology. I mean, hypnosis, all the things that I love. Whether it's PTSD or learning disabilities, or dream telepathy. I mean, pretty much anything humanistic, transpersonal, and existentially psychological, this man has tapped, if not created, the runway for. So I am honored to bring him on. Stanley Krippner, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. You've really done your homework.
I researched a lot about you, and I mean, I have this was one of my favorite finds. I found it in some bookstore, I think in New York City years ago. This copy of Dream Telepathy.
Yes.
And I remember seeing that and going, wow, they were doing this research back then. Here's what I'm curious about, Stanley. I mean, look, from everything I've read about you, from the people that you've worked with closely, you as a person seem to be as important in a lot of the people's views as the research itself. They say you're a magical person. They say you're somebody that is just full of love and knowledge and wisdom. What do you think that is? I mean, how do you feel about your personal legacy you've left behind and how it might relate to all the research you've done?
Again, I think maybe you're being overly generous because you have not mentioned all of the criticism I've had and
We'll get there.
all of the hardships I've had to maintain myself and do a little bit of contributions on the way. So you ask how it affects my personal life. I would say it expresses my personal life.
Do you feel overall that there's more love than there's been criticism, or do you think it's been balanced?
You're asking me a question that's very hard to answer because it's very linear in nature, and my life is not linear. My life is very chaotic. So you talked about balancing. That's not something that's easily comprehended because I try to live by moment to moment, day by day. So something comes up, I deal with it. If it's a compliment, I'm gratified. If it's a criticism, I learn from it what I can and go on.
I mean, no. I mean, I definitely think you are. I didn't mean to put you in the realm of linear, anything, given how multidimensional everything you've touched seems to be. Look, I think one of the things that fascinates me is that someone that I used to look at as an icon in this, I used to, before I started researching parapsychology and anomalies, I was 100% skeptical and in the James Randi camp. I thought James Randi was the god. He knew, which is kind of ironic, but he was the one that said, look, nobody can pass this test. I have not been able to give $1 million to anybody to prove that something paranormal is possible. But he liked you, Stanley. Why do you think that was?
Well, Randy and I always got along quite well, as a matter of fact, and I'm glad you picked up on that. And we, of course, had our disagreements, but I have to say that he did not do a broadsided attack on me the way he did on some of my colleagues. And I think that's because I could see some value in what he was getting at. When he began to unmask faith healers who were taking advantage of the public, I thought that was a great contribution, and I let him know about that. And we had a number of meetings over the years. And again, as I say, of course, we disagreed on the topic of parapsychology, but he actually had me come to his amazing conference in Las Vegas. I think I'm the only person who was interested in parapsychology invited to give a talk. So, of course, I accepted. And he gave me a $1,000 honorarium fine. But I didn't talk about parapsychology. I talked about the scams that were going on and the lies that were going on in the AIDS era. This was back in the days when AIDS was a hot topic. Now, of course, COVID is a hot topic. But there was so much misinformation about AIDS, especially from conservative religious groups that I had a field day in terms of exposing those to the audience. Needless to say, it was preaching to the converted, but at least it was entertaining to them and pulled together a lot of information that they did not otherwise know about. And also I gave the recipes for AIDS prevention. So I think that I put my time at his conference to good use. Wow. And then I have to say, I repeated that in a workshop I did in Russia, in St. Petersburg. I did a whole day's workshop on AIDS prevention, the first thing that had ever been done in Russia on that topic. And then I did the same thing in China. And China, of course, had been claiming that no, AIDS doesn't exist in our country. Of course, we know that was not true. And I think that my discussion on AIDS, this was not a full day, it was several hours, however, was introducing the topic of AIDS, the cause, the prevention, to an audience that had virtually no information. Wow. So I did put that time from Randy's conference to good subsequent use.
Yeah. That's so interesting that, I mean, you would not think of, look, I mentioned all the things that a lot of the broader fields that you've covered, but Stanley Krippner on one of the most, on the terminal sexual disease, I mean, that is not something I think people often associate with your name, your research on AIDS.
Well, they have not done their research, because if they'd done their research, they'd find out I've written dozens of articles on sexual research.
Why? Yeah, well, I know you on sexual research, but sexual diseases? Do you feel that? That's interesting.
Yes. Also, I did one of the very first study on the inner life of transsexuals as revealed in their dreams.
Right. Yeah, talk about that a little bit and how it fit into the other dream research you were doing in Brooklyn.
When we were doing our dream telepathy research in Brooklyn, we also used our laboratory for several other worthwhile projects, one of them exploring the dreams of pregnant women. We published the first article on dreams of pregnant women, found some very interesting items, most notably when pregnant women had dreams about monsters or small animals, they were more likely to have problems during childbirth than the women who didn't have that type of dream. So that could have been an interesting and useful diagnostic tool for people. Also, we collected dreams from male to female transgender patients. I was working with Harry Benjamin, who is the one who brought the gender reassignment operation to the United States.
Right.
And again, we found extremely interesting items in their dreams. We know the typical male dream, the typical female dream. The transgender dreams are right smack in the middle. So the dream life indicated something very deep within them that was happening. And again, this could have been used diagnostically. We know today so many people are claiming that they're transgender, and after a few years they decide they're not. If we could collect their dreams, then we could maybe get a better assessment of their gender identity at a very, very deep level.
Yes. So interesting. Did you have, what were your dreams like as a child?
Well, actually, I've been recording my dreams since my high school days. And so you say, what are my dreams like as a child? You have to be a little more specific.
I mean, did you have a lot of precognitive dreams? Were you lucid dreaming?
Neither.
Interesting.
I didn't have lucid dreams until I read the Carlos Castaneda books about looking at your hands before you go to sleep. A lot of what Castaneda wrote about was fantasy, of course. But he was right on target when he told people to look at their hands when they're falling asleep, and when your hands fall down, ask yourself what was going through my mind. Other useful tips. Anyway, it worked for me. In terms of precognitive dreams, I've had maybe two or three precognitive dreams in my life that I understood, that I remember that actually came true. So my dreams as a child were neither lucid nor precognitive.
Hmm.
I had dreams about people in my family, dreams about people in my school, my classmates, dreams about ordinary experiences that I was having in life.
Yeah. And what were you hoping by recording all those dreams? What have you put, how have you put those to use?
I thought that they would come in handy someday if I could review them. And I actually have several dozen notebooks full of my dreams. The problem is I developed very early on a type of shorthand that I use to this day. And so I'm afraid that though those volumes are going to go to waste, I'm not going to have the time to go through and transcribe them. All of my ordinary notebooks and diaries are going to State University of West Georgia, and they have all of my personal archives. So they will be getting copies of those dreams, but as I say, I don't think they'll be able to do much with them.
Yeah.
The other things I will send them in terms of letters and memorabilia, that'll be much more worthwhile and much more interesting for people to read.
That's interesting. That's interesting that there are aspects of your life that you're not even sure what to make of them still. I mean, I've heard you refer to yourself as agnostic even after all the anomalous research you've done over the years. When you say, I mean, does... Okay, I'd love for you to clarify what your position is on the paranormal as a broad field. I know that's a broad question. Like, when you say you're an agnostic about certain things, what do you mean? Let's start there.
I mean, I would not say that I'm 100% convinced of anything.
Mm.
Now, you take telepathic dreams, for example. Yes, I'm 99% convinced that these happen, but I'm not 110%. That's what I mean by agnostic. I'm not a dogmatic believer or unbeliever one way or the other. I like to leave some room to play with ideas, to reconsider ideas, to change my mind about ideas. And so when I say that I'm agnostic, I mean I'm never 100% sure about anything.
Yeah. Does that bother you at all? Is there any...
There are other things in life that bother me much more, practical things.
Okay.
But you're asking for things that I do not lose sleep over, no.
That's interesting. Yeah, because I know that I feel I'm agnostic as well. But, I mean, it certainly makes for an interesting life because I could read one of your books one day, then pick up... You know, I know one of your critics in the past was Martin Gardner, right? He said he was tough about some of the Russia stuff. So then I could pick up Martin Gardner's stuff and then go, oh, well, the Stanley Krippner guy isn't doing what he's doing. And it's a constant back and forth tension between two totally different views. So I'm sitting there, I'm going, well, I want to believe in something. Will I ever get to a point where I know it's real?
Then you look at the evidence.
Mm.
Everything that Martin Gardner wrote about me was false, incorrect, or distorted, without exception.
I believe that.
A friend of mine was going to arrange a debate between Martin Gardner and myself in North Carolina. I said, fine, bring him on. He refused.
Mm.
Who knows why he refused, but that would have been a good opportunity to discuss our differences in public and for me to call him on several statements he made about me, which were certainly not the case.
Do you remember the nature of those statements at all? Do you want to correct the record right now?
I would rather spend our time on something more useful.
But that's good. That's good.
I will just give you an example.
Okay.
He said that I was convinced that Nina Kalagin, who was the Russian psychic, was actually able to move objects without touching them.
Yeah.
I never said any such thing. I never met Kalagin myself, but I read reports about her work. I had films about her work. And I said, yes, this is worth investigating. This is worth studying. This is something of value. I never came out and said that everything she did was genuine and not fraud-proof.
Yeah.
There you have one example.
No, I was going to say, I thought that was a little weird of him to say. I have that book, and I was reading that passage, mm-hmm. and I thought, I don't feel like Stanley Krippner believes in levitation. I mean, have you ever seen anything in your research, levitation, that you can't explain?
Good heavens, no. As you know, I'm writing my memoirs right now. And so I feel like Nancy Reagan, who wrote a book about my side of the story, getting back. And she put to rest a lot of rumors about her and President Reagan and their belief systems that were not true.
Yeah.
Well, I feel the same way. My memoirs, if I live long enough to finish them, will be getting back and correcting a lot of the misstatements that people have made about me over the years. But of course, that's just a very minor part of my memoirs. The bulk of it will be more positive and hopefully very funny and interesting to people who read it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, look, I just imagine that someone like you. Well, did you ever work with Dr. Richard Allen Miller? He mentioned your name, I think.
Oh yes, I've known him for many years. Yes.
Yeah, he is someone that very openly talks about genuinely anomalous experiences that he has witnessed. Shamans jumping mountain from mountain. He says he's been to Mars. Now, when you read a Stanley Krippner paper, sure, you have the stories about Rolling Thunder, but I don't get the impression that reading your work is just this psychedelic trip of mystery and anomalies. So I'm curious, I mean, do you have those stories in your life where you looked at something and went, yeah, I don't even know how I would start explaining this because this man just flew in front of my eyes and I can't explain it?
In the first place, I don't think I have to explain everything I experience. I really do a That's minimum good. Explanation when I have something new coming into the picture. I like to record it. I like to document it. I like to describe it. Explanations can come later.
Yeah.
And I've had many experiences in my life and worked with many people who've done, which I really cannot explain fully. That's not my agenda. My agenda is to get something measured, get something recorded, get something described. And this will set the groundwork for future research, especially with combined with observations and measurements from other fields of interest.
Got it. That makes sense. Okay. Then here's what I'm going to ask you. I wrote something about neuropsychology and learning disabilities and your work with that. Do you feel, I mean, a lot of that work, learning disabilities, the other side of it is that once you can help somebody overcome a learning disability, you can teach people that already don't struggle to become like accelerated learners, speed reading or developing a better memory. Do you feel that you tapped into any of that work at all, as well as just helping people overcome debilitating learning struggles?
Oh, good heavens, yes, yes. I'm familiar with that work, and I've talked with people who are doing that work. That simply was not my focus.
Mm.
And also, back in the days when I was doing full-time work with learning disabilities, I did not buy the notion that learning disabilities were the result of poor parenting, poor mothering. And that just did not make sense in terms of what I observed and what I read in the literature. And I kept saying, no, there's something in the kid's brain that's not picking up. I remember very clearly when a mother brought her autistic son to me. And yes, he was like many autistic children that I saw, very bright, very sharp, actually very good looking, but not able to relate to me in any significant way. And she said, well, I read this book about the empty fortress, and I think that I'm the cause for my son's autism. Well, I know the book. It's complete nonsense, of course. And I said, no, your son's brain is wired differently than other children's brains. And that was such a relief to her. And much later, she got back to me through an intermediary saying, well, that conversation changed my life. Well, that's just one example of how psychoneurology has been so important from my very, very early days in the field, and why I keep being interested in the brain and the body. And sometimes when I see these anomalies, my first thought, what's going on in the brain at this time?
Yeah.
So I ask that question before I ask more ephemeral questions like, what's going on with the spirits? What's going on in the universe? No, I ask first, what's going on in the brain?
Yeah.
The brain and the body. Because I think the body actually is three brains, the one in the head, the one in the gut, the one in the heart, but that's a whole other issue.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting stuff. What do you mean by brain in the heart, in the gut? How would you define a brain?
They have a lot of neurotransmitters. There are more neurotransmitters in the gut than there are in the brain. The heart has its own neurotransmitters. Now, of course, much of this information is mediated through the brain, but the initial impulse can be in the gut or in the heart before anything else. And a lot of people miss out on that. And also, we put a lot of emphasis on rational thinking and logic and linear thinking, which is fine. But the heart and the gut don't behave that way. And so if we ignore our feelings, our gut feelings, our heart feelings, our intuition, our hunches, they are not always right. And I can speak from personal experience, but they need to be put into the equation.
That's very interesting. I did hear you talk in an interview recently about, you know, you were covering a lot of the stuff that you often cover in your career. And at the end, you said, you know, one thing I didn't really talk about in this interview and in general are my feelings on love and the importance of love in the world in general. Is there something that we can take from this understanding of what have you uncovered about love as it relates to the heart brain? Because I feel I don't know enough about it. And if I wouldn't want to just dismiss love as an evolutionary function to reproduce. Is there a way that we can know that it's something more based on any of your research?
What you need more? Yes, love is an evolutionary function. Isn't that enough? I think the importance of love is that it helped people survive. It helped people evolve. When Charles Darwin wrote his magnificent books, he emphasized love. In fact, he used the word love more often in his books than he used the word some other words that are attributed to him, like survival of the species. No, it was
survival of the fittest, right?
Survival of, he did not like that term. He did not like that term. And he felt that they emphasized the importance of cooperation, collaboration, and love. And at the same time, people had to be aggressive. They had to know how to fight to survive. So aggression also served an evolutionary function. So now we're in the situation where we don't really need that aggression anymore to survive. There's plenty of aggression in our institutions, but we certainly need love to keep surviving.
So you think that it's not, well, where does romance fit into that? You think it's just as, does it ruin the meaning of romance to just have a biological evolutionary function?
Oh, good heavens, of course not. Anything evolutionary can have other meaning. Look, music evolved. So we don't say, well, music is nothing but the brain going through its paces. No, of course, it's much more than that. Again, music triggers emotion. It triggers sentiment. That's where the gut and the heart come into the picture.
Yeah.
You can say that at any number of enjoyable things. Romance, of course, is wonderful. But you can't say, no, that's only this, it's only that. It appeals to our aesthetic sense, our romantic sense, our cooperative sense. So we do not use the term explain away. That's really counterproductive.
Yeah. And believe me, I'm on your side with this. I just know, like I said, coming from more of that skeptic background, there are a lot of people that are so stuck in empiricism and materialist explanations of reality that they would go so far as to say, yeah, even this date I went on last night, doesn't really have a lot of meaning because it's just so I can reproduce. So, you know, that's it's material science. Love is just a construction. We can, like you said, explain it away. What do you say to those people?
You see, this is where my existential background comes in. We need to bring meaning into our life. Maybe it doesn't have any meaning. If so, that's all the more reason why we have to bring meaning into our life. Also, you can make the case that our actions are sort of predetermined by our heredity and by our environment, by our past conditioning. Again, that might be so, but that doesn't negate the chance that we have to act like we have free will and ascribe meaning to what might be a very unmeaningful world. So again, I would go further than that. I have no problem with empiricism. I do have a problem with materialism, because my own hunch is that consciousness is primary and matter evolved out of consciousness, not the other way around. And so when people say, well, it's all the brain function, well, the brain mediates this whole field of consciousness in one way or another, each unique to its own unique organism. And by putting consciousness is primary, we are in agreement with some of the great thinkers like Schrödinger and David Bohm, who thought that that consciousness is primary, and built their quantum mechanical theories from that.
Yeah, the whole holographic universe idea.
That's right. And of course, the holographic paradigm for David Bohm and by Carl Priebram is something that's been too long neglected. And there are now a few articles, a few books we're picking up on that. And this is something I follow with great interest, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay.
So you see, I can imagine what's going on with some of the people who are listening and viewing. They're thinking, well, if consciousness is primary, this changes everything. No, it doesn't change how we go about our daily life. It changes in terms of philosophers, psychologists, psychiatrists, people who deal with the so-called mind. That's where it will make the changes, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you've studied, I mean, you know, for those that aren't as familiar with Stanley's work, I mean, altered states of consciousness is really, it's a great umbrella for a lot of what you've done, whether it's dreams, whether it's shamans, hypnosis. I mean, I've studied hypnosis. I know you in your lifetime. I mean, did you actually meet Milton Erickson?
Oh, good heavens, yes. I knew Milton Erickson. I went to many of his seminars. I corresponded with him. He, of course, was a marvelous psychiatrist.
Yeah,
and he took the whole field of hypnosis into new dimensions. Thank heavens, the transcripts of his lectures are now available so people can learn from his lectures and videos him at work. He was a masterful hypnotist, and I have seen him at work at some of these workshops. And so I just can't say enough in terms of praising him. Also, I had the great fortune of meeting two of his daughters, and one of them gave me a little puppet of Milton Erickson. With his purple jumpsuit on. Milton Erickson was colorblind. The only color he could see was purple.
Right.
So when he went out in public, he wore a purple jumpsuit. And that was something that helped contrast him from other people. Quite a remarkable man, yes.
Yeah, very hypnotic. But, you know, I found it interesting that I believe you said that the one person that ever got you into trance via hypnosis was Spiegel. Right?
Oh, good heavens, yes, yes. This is a workshop. Again, I'm not a very hypnotizable person, but
I'm not either, but I love hypnosis still.
Well, there you are. So with Dr. Spiegel, it's just for demonstration, took me through the paces, and I had a post-hypnotic suggestion that actually worked. Well, I've never had that before. So for one reason or another, he gave me a very unique experience, yes.
Yeah. Do you, in all your research of hypnosis, and I don't know if you focused on this as much because I haven't dug too deeply into all your papers, though I'm planning to, but I'm curious, do you think there's a reason some people are more hypnotizable than others?
Of course, there's research on this. And again, for one thing, it's a function of the brain. Some people, simply from a neurological point of view, cannot pay attention closely or cannot imagine very well. And it can be also a result of their environment. I know any number of people who cannot be hypnotized, and I go into their background. Yes, they were molested as children. So who are they going to put trust in? Somebody
Right.
that puts them into a altered state, and I take it. Of course, they don't think this consciously, but unconsciously, it still is there. So I think there are both environmental and biological reasons for people being resistant to hypnosis.
Yeah. And I know you've talked about expectation. You think I know a lot of hypnotists talk about expectations as an important part of a hypnosis session. Do you still think that's the case?
Expectation, of course, is very important. Some people have that I've worked with have such high expectations that they're half hypnotized by the time I see them. And all they need is permission from me to go into hypnosis. And then I put them through the hypnosis ritual, and then they're very happy. They're deeply in hypnosis, and we can do whatever task we've agreed upon doing. I've hypnotized maybe a dozen people and have gotten them to stop smoking. And I am not a psychotherapist, so I don't use hypnosis in psychotherapy, but I have used hypnosis in terms of helping students concentrate before an exam, other things like that, very practical uses.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting, Stanley, too, is that expectation, even when it comes to witnessing a shaman, for instance, do a miracle. I mean, I know that a lot of some of the research that you've done has stressed the importance of the culture involved with indigenous peoples, them believing that shape-shifting is just part of their daily reality. I'm curious about people that don't necessarily have it as part of their life and still witness a miracle. Have you encountered that, or do you think there always has to be a little bit of an expectation in order to experience the miraculous in your life?
Well, you've hit on a very important topic. I really am upset when I see people demean indigenous wisdom and indigenous cultures. The indigenous cultures, at least in many, many ways, and for many, many cultures, have provided a roadmap for living that more modern cultures are not giving them. So I think that we have to be very circumspect before we start criticizing too much indigenous belief systems. Now, having said that, within many of these indigenous communities, the expectation is so high for unusual things happening that when people have a precognitive dream, for example, no, that's not an anomaly. That's par for the course. That's one of the things that dreams do. So they take
Yes.
that in stride. Same thing with a number of anomalies. What might be anomalous in our culture is not necessarily anomalous in another person's culture. Now, if you want to ask, well, are these belief systems valid? It depends what you mean. It depends what you mean by valid. Are they working for a person? Are they bringing health and happiness to a culture? If they are, let's not push our luck. Let's just let them do what they want.
Interesting. Well, I certainly know. I mean, even with your story, your personal story with the precognitive dream about your uncle's passing, that certainly must have laid the groundwork for you to even believe that doing research into dream telepathy could be a thing, or any of the various fields. I mean, do you even think it would have been po- imagine you didn't have a precognitive experience. Do you think your research would have convinced you that that was possible without having a personal experience first?
You know, this is a hypothetical question, and I do not like hypothetical questions. I
fair enough.
I have no idea.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Okay. Yeah, I'm playing with thought experiments.
Let's go back to what actually happened. Yes, I had a hunch that my uncle had died, and 5 minutes later, my mother got a phone call confirming that. It was, of course, a great tragedy for the family because my uncle was a very young man. Very successful in his own way. And that got me interested in the topic. And I read what I could on it. I didn't tell anybody about that experience for years, but I did make some notes on it, and much years later. And also, I got interested in a radio show, The Amazing Dunninger.
Yes, yes.
Dunninger was a mentalist, a stage magician.
Yeah.
And what he did on the radio sounded absolutely valid to me, predicting the headlines in tomorrow's papers, giving social security numbers of people in the audience. Yes, all of that was remarkable. Then when I began studying magic more thoroughly, I found out how each of Dunninger's mentalism acts was done. Very ingenious. Requires so much skill, I would think the telepathy would have been much easier. But yes, and then coincidentally, a friend of mine, a psychiatrist friend of mine, actually knew Dunninger. I got to meet him.
Amazing.
I got to meet him at the magic show in New York City. We were in the front row. This is a famous magic show because the magician in the sawing a woman in half trick headed to the jury. So when the bus saw went in, blood and guts actually spewed into the audience.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah, some people sued and they had to have their dry cleaning bills paid by the company, but it didn't matter. It brought in many, many people. And then, of course, for a few dollars, you go up on stage and you could look into the box and see how the young woman had very cleverly contorted herself into one half of the box, and the other half of the box was the one that was sawed through the middle.
Wow. Fascinating. So Dunninger was there.
And so he was there and he saw it. Yeah, of course, he knew right away how it was done, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is how you became interested for sure. And yeah, I mean, you can't dismiss this part of the story.
But then when I came into the University of Wisconsin, I had a professor who actually told us about parapsychology. His name was Campbell Garnett, a professor of philosophy. And it was thanks to him that I learned about how these experiences could be studied scientifically and had been studied scientifically. So I think that that was very pivotal in my interest, the course in philosophy that I took from Professor Garnett.
Yeah. Was there, let me ask you this, what was the first piece of research that you can recall that made you go, yeah, there is good evidence for the anomalous? You can't just explain this away.
Well, at that time, J.B. Rhine had come out with his first book.
Yes.
And so this is what I read, and that had all of the statistics from his card-guessing experiments. And so I would say that that was the first body of work. And of course, I later became good friends with Dr. Rhine and his wife, and I'm still friends with their daughter, Sally Rhine Feather, who has just put together a wonderful collection of his letters from years gone by. Oh, my God. Letters going back decades before I actually met him. He was very, very thoughtful to record those letters. I would never have thought of that. I get letters and I throw them away. No, he kept all of those letters. He knew that posterity would be interested in them.
That's very interesting. I want to pivot back to something for a second because I want to make sure I hit this. One of the things that I think you did very well in your career was taking psi phenomenon, psychic, ESP, all that stuff, away from the pathological explanation. it's not just something, it's not just a delusion, it's not just something in your brain, there's something else going on. For those that are out there that are going, no, it's all in their head, there's no way, it's just all made up, they're deluding themselves. What do you think is substantive in your research that made you think that's...
I think that this is perhaps, from my point of view, the most important contribution our research has made. By taking the so-called telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition experiences into the laboratory, studying in the laboratory, and so, yes, there is evidence that these things actually are possible. This brings a lot of relief to people who thought that their experiences were pathology. And they were often told by their psychotherapists that this was a delusion. And also their parents. I've had so many examples of this. One dramatic example was a young woman who came to me. She was having out-of-body experiences as a child. And on one occasion, there was a house fire down the street, and her parents said, "Now you stay home. You're too young to enjoy this. We'll go and check it out." And she just went out of her body and went and watched the house burn down, came back to her body, and the parents came, and she told them all about it. And they said, "Well, you sneaked out of the house. The only way you could have found out about this," they severely punished her. She never had an out-of-body experience again.
Wow. So that's just, So, you put evidence to things that people were saying, "No, it's all in your head." I mean, I have friends that look at my bookshelf and they go, "Yeah, aren't these people all crazy?" And I just want to say, have you read the evidence? Is that what you would say to people that, you know, if I don't think you take the time to like go to a bar and defend your research, but if you had to point someone towards research that this isn't pathological, where would you have them start?
Well, actually, I think the best place to start, if they were at all scientifically inclined, would be to go to the American Psychologist, which is the flagship journal of the American Psychological Association, and read the article of Etzel Cardenia about parapsychological research. He presents half a dozen bodies of evidence, including dream ESP, by the way, dream telepathy. And each one of these bodies of evidence has withstood criticism and should stand as a demonstration of the validity of our endeavors. And if they go and read that, I think that would be the best suggestion I could give. That would be the one place that pulls together a lot of evidence, not only from the United States, but from other countries as well, and puts it all into one very good bundle.
Yeah. Did you ever meet John Mack?
Oh, good heavens, yes. I knew John Mack. What a shame that he was killed in London. That hit me very personally by a driver who went through. Just makes me too sad even to think of. That was such a great, great loss for us.
I was going to say, I mean, this is another example. Now, I am curious why, you know, or how you've been able to stay out of, or at least I don't see a lot about ETs and UFOs in your research, perhaps beyond the actual, like, things in dreams. But John Mack was kind of doing the same thing, right? For these abduction experiences. He said, "I've done the research. This isn't pathological." Did you see similarities in any of his research to yours?
I didn't understand your last question.
Oh, was there any, do you think like his research as a psychiatrist examining these abduction phenomena and getting rid of the pathology explanation is similar at all to anything you researched?
Oh, okay. Now I understand. Good question. Yes, I think it is. Now, again, I read John Mack's books on the topic. This is an area where I'm agnostic. But I will say that he has presented considerable evidence that people had ET that had ET or UFO experiences. Now, just in March of this year, I was in Houston, Texas for the dedication of their Archives of the Impossible. They have all of my professional writings there. They have professional writings from John Mack and other UFO researchers. And some of the UFO researchers were there to give presentations, and thousands of people are tuning in on that dedication remotely. And of course, I was there in person. And again, they make a very, very good case that there is such a thing as a UFO or an unidentified aerial phenomenon, and that a few people have had some sort of interaction with the intelligences. I'm not even going to use the word people. They're agencies, they're intelligences of some sort involved in those. Again, this is an idea that I find interesting. It's something I sort of play around with. It's not on the top of my agenda, but I think that it's worthwhile investigating. So, of course, I follow the developments with great interest.
Yeah.
But again, I think that psychotherapists who are paying attention to the literature, they don't have to be convinced that the parapsychological phenomena exist. They don't have to be convinced that alien abductions occur. But all they have to do is say, this is a possibility. It's not necessarily pathological, because so many people have these experiences, and that there is some data backing up their experience. If they can do that, that's fine. I'm glad we've all made a contribution.
Yes. Okay. I want to wrap this up, but I want to focus in on the altered state thing before we go. Especially because you've done a lot of research into psychedelics and creativity. Some people I've talked to try LSD or do mushrooms, and it's just a pleasant experience. Some people talk about having a psychedelic experience and it changes everything. And you've done all this research about the great artists who all of a sudden had creative breakthroughs. What do you think is the difference? When do psychedelics really open something up for someone versus just, oh, it was a fun time?
Well, again, this is of great interest to me, because 50 years ago, I became interested in LSD and the other psychedelics. And again, not being a psychotherapist, there was no way that I could put them to use, but I did interview people like the artists you mentioned. And I did see the potential of psychedelics as being a therapeutic tool. Mm-hmm. And I've had to wait 50 years to finally find this happening. I'm so delighted I lived long enough to see psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy on the front lines of innovative psychiatric and psychological and psychotherapeutic treatment. I'm just delighted. So going back all of those years, this is a complicated topic. I knew Timothy Leary, and I knew Ram Dass, I knew Ralph Metzner. I thought that they had gone off the deep end, but right. Even so, history will deal with them better than it will deal with the people that were opposed to them and criminalized them and were very unnecessarily hostile toward them. So this is one positive experience of knowing history and seeing how things change, how things evolve. Also, back in those days, it was Timothy Leary, one of my visits with Timothy Leary, that some students from MIT brought in marijuana. Hmm. And yeah, this was my first marijuana experience. Tim's also. And this is what got him interested in marijuana. And then I started to do some research on marijuana. No, it's not the gateway drug that people are claiming it is. This is something that has positive medicinal benefits. And in 1974, I came out with an article endorsing this and predicting the legalization of marijuana. This was 1974.
Wow.
And thank heavens I've lived long enough to see this come true.
Yeah. I mean, so you do believe that these days it's worth exploring these psychedelic medicines, these earth medicines.
Okay, you talk about the difference. The difference is going to be substance, set, and setting, the three S's. Substance, you have to make sure that the psychedelics are unadulterated, that they are what they claim to be. If they're not, that's the end of the game. Setting is the location and the place where it takes place. And if you take LSD on the street, this is much different than taking it in the comfort of your home. And then the third is the set. And the set involves your expectations,
right?
Your brain connections, whether you're doing it alone, with a group, or best of all, have a guide to take you through it. So a combination of substance, set, and setting will answer your question.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a ton of sense. Very cool. Well, look, one final thing I now realize. I wanted to ask about mythology. You've dealt with personal mythology. Personal mythology is this thing that you've really popularized. I mean, people were coming to you in colleges and sharing their dreams with you in the morning. I'm curious, beyond Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell, what do you feel like you... What specifically in your work, because I know you give a lot of credit to them, but what do you think you have specifically done in your work that's gone beyond what we know of them? Because I want people to give you credit. I know some people do, but I want everybody to give you more credit for your contributions.
Oh, good heavens. I would never say I've done anything that goes beyond Carl Gustav Jung and Joseph Campbell. Not at all. No, I've just filled in a couple of the gaps, taken mythology in a couple of directions, and put it to practical use.
That's Joseph what I was going to say. Is it the practical nature?
Yeah,
of...
yeah, Joseph Campbell actually liked what we were doing with personal mythology in our workshops, and he was actually going to write a foreword to our book on personal mythology. And I was so appreciative of him. He was in Hawaii at the time. Then a secretary wrote saying he will be unable to write the foreword. He just passed away. Oh, my God, I just heard from him a few weeks ago. Here he was literally on his deathbed, and he still was reaching out, hoping that he could write something. We did use a sentence or two that he had written earlier. But, yes, he was a very dear friend of mine, and I would not at all think that I had gone anywhere above and beyond what he contributed. But, as you said, what David Feinstein did in her book, Personal Mythology, which your listeners and viewers can actually buy on Amazon.com, is to take the whole concept of myth as an explanatory system and put it to practical use. This is a bit difficult because of the vernacular. A myth is a fable. It's something that's not true. And so we have to get people past that semantic problem, which is why if they want to call it a life script, fine. If they want to call it something else, a narrative, a life narrative, that's fine. I don't care what they want to call it, but it's a systems of beliefs, emotions, and actually unconscious images that form the roadmap by which we're going to live our lives. And the more clearly we know about that, the better. So this was the contribution that Personal Mythology, our book, did, which is sort of a self-help book, and which is still in print, still being sold. Psychotherapists are still using it. Sidian Jones, who you should interview in one of your podcasts, has adapted it for children in his My Mythos website.
Oh, wow.
So it's still taking off, yes.
Yeah. And that quote of yours, any product of human imagination represents a form of reality. I've heard Dr. Richard Allen Miller on this show said, anything you can imagine, anything is real. I don't know if that's similar to what you're saying, but when you say that, what do you mean? Any bit of the human represents a form of reality.
Again, this is complicated.
I know.
Listeners and viewers could look at the book by Irving Laszlo what is reality? And I have a chapter in the book addressing this issue, a chapter I wrote with Alan Combs about reality from a chaotic point of view. We use chaos theory to approach this issue. And so when you say anything that you can imagine is reality, yeah, this is a special type of reality. It's not the reality that's immediately in front of us, but it's a reality at some other level. So we should not put it down, because when that becomes its own reality, it will start influencing how we run our lives. So what we imagine is going to affect us. So let's try to imagine positive things, helpful things, cheerful things, and constructive things. Too many people, including myself from time to time, spend too much of our time imagining scenarios of disaster that will never come true. Or if they do come true, we won't know how to deal with them because we have not prepared ourselves in advance. And so there is a certain amount of validity to that statement if you look at it from our point of view.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. I mean, Dr. Stanley Krippner, this has been an amazing conversation. You know, is there anybody in the field that, I know this might be a controversial question, but I just want to know, is there anybody big name in mainstream science that knows that your research presents validity for the anomalous, but hasn't admitted it publicly?
Actually, I can think of two or three examples of people, some of their prominent people, who say, yes, I know that what I'm studying is valid. I've had those experiences myself, but I don't dare make them public or my job would be at risk. And aside from the people who have told me this person, yes, there are dozens of cases that other people have identified where in academia, especially very conservative academia, well, look what happened to John Mack. He was criticized severely for his work on alien abductions. And if people are identified too closely with, shall we say, anomalous experiences and topics to study them, yes, in some parts of the country, this is putting their academic reputation at risk. Too bad, but that's the way it is.
Yeah, I hope that changes. I hope.
Yeah, it's changing slowly. It's changing slowly. Also.
Yeah. That's good. That's good. I mean, now that's gave me one more question. I have to ask, is there a case when an anomalous phenomenon is pathological, you think? Is that ever a possibility?
Oh, all the time, of course. Just think of all the people who are on record. They commit some terrible crime, even killing their own children. Oh, yes. The angels told me to do it. God told me to do it. The devil told me to.
Right.
Ascribing agency to something outside of themselves. And
right.
Of course, this is pathological. And the voices that they hear are, of course, in their head. When you say it's all in your head, to a certain extent, that's true. Everything is all in our head, or everything is all in our body. But when it comes to pathology, the most dangerous stuff that's all in our head is the voices that urge acts of terrorism, acts of domestic violence, acts of some site of malfeasance or murder. Of course, this is a danger. And this is pathological. And again, even though I value cultural differences, there is a line that I do not cross. I can give you examples of this. There are certain things that I think have to surpass culture in terms of value, and respect for human life is one of them.
Yes.
Another example, I've long been in opposition to the practice in too many cultures of the world, cutting off a woman's clitoris when she's in puberty, clitorectomy. And why do they do this? So a woman wouldn't have too much desire. She wouldn't cheat on her husband. This is barbarism. I've heard people defend this, but that's their culture. That's their point of view. No, women's rights go beyond culture. I'm sorry. But there are other examples like this too, where I think that some issues are so important that they're human values They surpassed cultural values.
Wow, wow, wow. This guy, get this guy for president. Dr. Stanley Krippner should be president. I mean, these are great ideas and important ideas. And it's amazing that, you know, you were, yeah, even back in the 50s, 60s, I mean, you were very ahead of your time politically, ideologically. Yeah, I'm very impressed by that.
Oh, I think you're easily impressed, but thank you very much.
No.
I do have to say that I saw the folly of the Vietnam War early on. I was in the first march against the Vietnam War in Manhattan. I followed the war closely. I won't even get into some of the personal efforts that I took against the war. But again, I hate to say this, but I was vindicated. I was on the right side of history.
Yeah.
I'm not bragging too much because I've made so many disastrous mistakes in my personal life. So I am not holding myself up to a paragon of virtue or excellence. Far from it. I've made many, many mistakes, but at least not in my professional life.
I was going to say, I mean, look, you are somebody, I look at you as somebody to model in going deep in your interests, like from a personal development point of view. I'm going, how did this man, Dr. Stanley Krippner, do dream research and then tackle learning disabilities and then explore hypnosis and shamans? Do you have a different view of day-to-day life, of time? Was time ever a barrier, or did you just say, nope, I'm interested, I'm going to follow this passion?
Well, this will have to be the last question because my voice is giving up.
Oh, no worries, no worries. I just want to know how to have
I'm always running out of time. And running out of time has in some way affected my life very negatively. Some of the terrible mistakes I've made in my life are simply because I did not have enough time to finish something or do something well. All that I can say is at least I have had enough time for these professional endeavors that you mentioned, at least most of them. And I simply focus on the moment. This is how I do these things. One task at a time. I'm not very good at multitasking. I do one thing at a time and become completely immersed in something, follow it through till it's confused. Now, this sometimes involves going from one topic one day to another topic another day. Fine, as long as I can be fully present with what I'm doing at the time.
Yes. Well, look, I am so grateful for the amount of work that you've done in this field, for never being afraid to go into areas that people would call taboo, and for sharing your presence here, for taking the time to do this. I'm very grateful. Dr. Stanley Krippner, a legend. I'm spreading your name far and wide. I think you should be taught in the schools. thank you again for coming on this show. Really, I'm honored to meet you and have this conversation. Thank you.
You're so welcome. Thank you for doing your homework. Thank you for your intelligent questions, and all the best to you in your future work.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Doctor. Dr. Stanley Krippner, thank you so much for coming on. We're going to put up the YouTube interview, so make sure you follow the YouTube channel. Link is in the show notes. Wow, do I praise these guests too much? He said I overcomplimented. One time someone said that my interview integrity was ruined by how much praise I had for the guest. And I really appreciated him in his comment. Really, thank you for tearing me apart and crapping on my integrity. Much love. Oh, and thank you, because you listened. I love you. You're perfect. Never change. Talk soon.